From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Senator Bill Bradley. The three-term senator from New Jersey has decided to retire from office at the end of the year. A record number of House and Senate members have made the same decision this year. We'll talk with Senator Bradley about why he's leaving the Senate, and we'll discuss his career from the New York Knicks to the halls of Congress. Bradley has written a new memoir. Also, classical music critic Lori Schwartz reviews cellist Yo-Yo Ma's debut recording with the New York Philharmonic under Kurt Mazur. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Federal Reserve has cut short-term interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point to help boost the economy and guard against a recession. The Fed funds rate, which banks charge on overnight loans, is being lowered to 5.25%, and the discount rate, the rate the Fed charges banks for loans, is being reduced to 5%. Such moves normally trigger reductions in the rates charged consumers. It was the second interest rate cut in as many months, and it had been widely anticipated in the wake of recent data indicating sluggishness in the economy. The Senate Finance Committee is today hearing recommendations on tax reform. Former Housing Secretary and Congressman Jack Kemp is outlining his commission's recommendations. They include replacing the current tax code with a simpler flat tax system.
It's time to replace this failed system with a new, simplified tax rate system for the 21st century. A single low rate, taxing income but once, with a generous personal exemption for low income, and full deductibility of the payroll tax on the principle that we should not tax taxes.
Kemp's panel does not recommend a specific flat tax rate. He says that number should be worked out in congressional hearings. Democrats and Republicans on the panel voice support for tax reform, but Louisiana Democrat John Breaux said he's concerned about the fairness of a flat tax system. A truck loaded with hundreds of pounds of explosives blew up in downtown Colombo, Sri Lanka this morning, killing 55 people and injuring at least 1,400 others. The death toll is expected to rise. The attack is being blamed on Tamil Tiger rebels. Democratic Congressman Ron Wyden's victory in the special election to fill the Oregon Senate seat being vacated by Bob Packwood is being seen as a good omen by congressional Democratic leaders, UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports.
Congressman Bonnier of Michigan, the second-ranking Democrat in the House, said in effect that Wyden's narrow victory over conservative Republican Gordon Smith was a referendum on the Republican control of Congress.
It was a magnificent victory for the message that we have been preaching now for the last 12 to 13 months, protecting Medicare and Medicaid, fighting for continued 25 years of additional progress on the environmental front, and making sure that education is a top priority in this country.
Republicans can take solace in the narrowness of the victory. Smith lost by only 1%. He supported much of the Republican agenda. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
The man accused of killing basketball star Michael Jordan's father has been released from a North Carolina hospital. Daniel Green was treated for stomach pains. His illness forced a recess in the trial until tomorrow. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 8 points at 5,373 in heavy trading. In the over-the-counter market, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up nearly 2 points. This is NPR News. A U.S. sailor stationed in Japan has been sentenced by a court in Tokyo to 4 years in prison for trying to strangle his Japanese girlfriend. Prosecutors say 23-year-old Jackie Barker repeatedly choked his girlfriend during a fight last summer. She suffered serious brain damage and remains hospitalized. Two of the nation's largest health insurers have announced plans to merge. Melba Gomez of member station WBEZ in Chicago reports.
Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Illinois and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas say they will combine operations. Officials from both plans say the move is intended as a first step toward a full merger, and it brings together two of the strongest Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans in the United States. Blue Cross Blue Shield Illinois CEO Ray McCaskey says the move will keep both organizations competitive in an era of managed care and rapid changes in the healthcare industry. The two plans cover nearly 4 million subscribers and have combined annual revenues of over $5 billion. Company officials say they don't know if the merger will lead to any layoffs. Both companies will continue to offer health maintenance and preferred provider organizations in their individual states. The merger will require regulatory approval. For National Public Radio, I'm Melba Gomez in Chicago.
Sniper attacks against NATO peacekeepers in Bosnia are on the rise in a Serb-held suburb of Sarajevo. But a NATO spokesman says the alliance plans to work through civilian authorities to counter the threat. There were two attacks on NATO vehicles Tuesday. In one, a British soldier was slightly wounded. More Serbs are leaving the Sarajevo suburbs that are set to come under control of the Muslim Croat Federation under the terms of the Dayton Peace Accord. But the Muslim-led government is still refusing to allow free traffic across the Bridge of Brotherhood and Unity, which links the Serb suburbs to government-held areas of the capital city. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last August, Senator Bill Bradley announced he would not seek re-election this year. Bradley, who is now 52, is finishing his third term representing New Jersey. He had considered running in the Democratic presidential primary in 92 and has not ruled out the possibility of running this year as an independent. He gave one of the keynote addresses at the 92 Democratic National Convention. Before entering politics, Bradley was a star basketball player. He played with the New York Knicks for 10 years and was a 3-time basketball All-American at Princeton. He wrote about his basketball career in his memoir, Life on the Run. He reviews his political career in his new memoir, Time Present, Time Past. Over 30 House and Senate members announced their retirements this year. That's a record number for the 20th century. I asked Senator Bradley why he decided not to seek re-election.
Well, I think being a U.S. Senator is the best elective job in the world, and I'm going to leave a part of myself on the floor of the U.S. Senate just like I left a part of myself on the floor of Madison Square Garden when I stopped playing professional basketball. But being a U.S. Senator is a time-consuming job. You have 12, 14-hour days, committees, subcommittees, caucuses, thinking through complex issues. I write about some of that in the Time Present, Time Past, and also then back and forth to your state. And it, frankly, doesn't give me enough time to do what I think I want to do, and that I also think is in the public interest. And that is to try to energize a movement on outside of Washington to take money out of politics, particularly money, campaign finance reform. There are referendums this year in California, Colorado, Arkansas, and Maine, and there will be more in the years to come. And second, I want to think through the next chapter of the American story, meaning I want to try to give millions of Americans who don't know where things are headed because they've lost their job or their wages are stagnant or they wonder about their children's future or they've lost their health care or their pension. And I want to begin to think through, well, where is this information revolution taking us? Let me formulate a story about where it's headed and then interact with people. And out of that gives them some sense of where we're going as a country.
There's something that I think might be missing from your answer about why you're leaving the Senate. You never said in your answer that you're fed up with politics. Are you fed up with politics?
Politics has its major limitations today. The mean-spiritedness of campaigns, the constant quest for money to finance campaigns. So, I think politics today could be better, but the Senate is a unique institution, and I leave the Senate with a great deal of respect for it and have had a great experience in it and believe that you can accomplish important things in the Senate. But the Senate isn't the only place that you can accomplish things. So I make a distinction between the Senate and politics as it is now practiced in this country.
Are you still considering running as an independent for president?
Yes. I mean, I've thought a lot about the presidency, and someday I would like to run for the presidency. And, you know, I think that I've worked a long time to try to understand this country and the rhythms of this country. I also, in part, wrote this book so that people would know me, because I don't think that you run for president and are able to lead without people knowing who you are. And I think that's one of the shortcomings of many people who run for president. They're just the positions that they've stated.
You campaigned very vigorously for Bill Clinton. Are you considering running against him as an independent?
Well, you know, if there were an opening in 1996, I'd do it. But it's very difficult now. I think that independent candidacies are fraught with obstacles, particularly financial obstacles. I mean, the nominees of each party get about $72 million from the public, and an independent gets zero and has to raise money in $1,000 contributions. So it is very difficult to do. From my own perspective, I think that if there was an opening, I would take it. And I haven't ruled it out, but it is unlikely that in the coming months there will be that kind of opening.
Have you been disappointed in President Clinton's performance in the White House?
I think he's done many things well. I've worked with him on a number of his major achievements, particularly in the areas of world trade, the agreements with Mexico, the international community, the so-called GATT agreement, his decision to give most favored nation treatment to China are all things that I've worked closely with him on and I have supported fully. Then there are those things where I think we share basic impulses, such as racial healing in the country. And on those issues, we have share basic impulses, but maybe have a little different emphasis or priority or style. I'd like to see him, for example, speak out more frequently on the need for racial healing and remind us of our history and educate people about how these stupid divisions based on race divide us and diminish us as individuals and as a people.
This is your first year in Congress that has both the House and the Senate with a Republican majority. Has that changed life for you as a senator?
Well, I was in a Republican Senate between 80 and 86, and the rough rule of thumb there was the way you get things done as a Democrat in a Republican Senate is you have a good idea and they'll steal it. And indeed, that's what happened with tax reform in 1986. This current crop of Republicans, they don't particularly want to negotiate or hear a Democrat with an idea, and so they have they're marching to their own drummer. So it's not an experience in this year that is similar to the other experiences that I've had in the Senate, even in a Republican Senate. And I think that's too bad because the Senate is really a place where even divergent views come together. I mean, the essence of the legislative process, the United States Senate anyway, is a combination of substance, you got to know what you're talking about, procedure, you got to know the language of how to get it done, and personality, which means people who have different views but come together in order to get a compromise that allows them to move the country 1 inch or 3 inches forward, as opposed to standing in each corner of the room shouting at each other. And that personality aspect of the Senate requires maturity, and it requires people who respect each other. For example, some of my best friends in the Senate are Republicans, many of whom have different views than I do. And let me just give you an example of how this human element plays out. I remember, take Senator Alan Simpson, who's a conservative. He clearly has different views than I do on many issues. But we've kind of crossed the waters of partisan divide by, empathetic feelings for each other, by being able to listen to each other, by straight shooting with each other. And once we were on an extended Nightline program during the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas battle, and we were on opposite sides. And during this evening, we exchanged very harsh words with each other before a national television audience of where 6 to 10 million people. And it went on for, it was supposed to be a half an hour. They kept going an hour. They kept going about an hour and a half by the time it was over. And by the time it was over, it was, way after midnight. I was drained. At the end, I was trembling a little bit because of the exchanges that I'd had with him. And then I sat there on a set, and I realized as I turned my mind to other things that I was supposed to get a quart of milk for our daughter at the grocery store. And I looked in my pocket. I didn't have any money. So the question is, who am I going to borrow money from? Well, there's Al sitting across on the stage, so I walk over and say, "Hey, Al, can you lend me $10 so I can go get a quart of milk for our daughter?" And he gives me the $10 without asking a question. I go to an all-night grocery, buy a quart of milk, and then I buy a box of Wheaties, and when I do, I think of Al.
So you're forever indebted.
forever indebted. And of course, I repaid it at least in a day or a week or a month or 2 months. I'm sure I repaid it, though.
Senator Bill Bradley is my guest, and he's written a new memoir called Time Present, Time Past. Senator, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Great.
This is Fresh Air. Senator Bill Bradley is my guest, and he's decided not to run for re-election. He's written a memoir called Time Present, Time Past. In your memoir, you point out that some of the issues that have been most important to you and that have taken up much of your time have not been issues that are really in the public eye, like third world debt and, you know, chairing the subcommittee on water and power. You write, the issues I championed didn't move people. I had mounted no crusade for abortion rights or against TV violence. There were not calls to protect American jobs or to confront greedy big business. What are you saying there, that some of the people who do call for that are cynically manipulating the voters, or are you expressing regret that you didn't get behind more popular issues, more emotional issues?
No, that was an observation in the book that I had while I was speaking to a fundraiser in Washington State. And I had that because it was yet another fundraiser. I was yet in another living room. I was yet trying to appeal to a diverse audience of both Republicans and Democrats by being kind of in the middle. And in the process of doing that yet another time, I thought about what I had not done. I had been for about 10 years a legislator who sought the center, who sought compromise. I had not been someone who had sharp edges and who stepped out on extremely controversial issues. And I realized that while I was a very successful legislator in terms of bringing about big reform, because you don't get it by the soundbite, you got to know it in great detail, whether it's tax reform, international debt, or water policy, I had not kind of led as much from my gut as I had from my mind. And therefore, I decided that partially because of that realization, partially because my reelection in 1990 had liberated me, the narrow re-election, and partially because I had gone through some very difficult personal times in 1992 with a wife who developed breast cancer and chemotherapy and mastectomy. I had parents with advancing emphysema and the second parent with heart and cancer. I had two friends die in an airplane accident, and I had one friend commit suicide. And the thought came to me, well, you know, how much longer are you going to be around here? And how, if you're gone tomorrow, because for the first time in my life I contemplated, well, maybe things don't go on forever, even though I obviously knew that intellectually in the past, this was the first moment that it really kind of hit me. Well, then you better speak from your heart as well as your mind, and you better do it on whatever issue is out there, controversial or not. And indeed, I became a better public leader because I reached deeper into myself to find that part of me which before I had not developed, because I thought that it would make me less effective as a legislator.
Give me an example of what you mean.
In the so-called Rodney King episode, I saw it on television. The jury verdict came back in. I was absolutely incensed. And instead of thinking about it for a couple of days, I went right to the Senate floor. And I wanted to express my outrage, and I wanted to convey to people what it felt like to get 56 blows on your body from the LAPD if you were Rodney King. And so spontaneously, I took some pencils, and I put my watch on the podium, and I timed 2 minutes and hit 56 blows with the pencils on the edge of the podium in 2 minutes. So, and that's all. No speaking in that period, just so people could sense what it was like. And it was at the end, I was trembling with anger. And obviously, when people saw it on television, it it electrified them. Some people wrote me letters of deep and abiding hatred. Other people wrote me letters tremendously positive. One person even wrote a symphony in Philadelphia called 56 Blows because he was so moved by the speech. The point is, it was the intensity of the reaction which was different, and it was me yielding to my gut and finding a way to have that expressed that was different. And really, that's, I think, what has made me a better public leader.
Well, it certainly is true that no one would accuse you of being given to emotional displays. And in public and in your book, you talk about your charisma problem, that you're not high in charisma, you've had problems with public speaking, and that's been something of a problem in your public life. You're laughing.
Well, I find it to be somewhat humorous because on the one hand, you know, you don't get major tax reform. You don't convince Republicans and Democrats to do it if you can't communicate. So on one level, I can communicate pretty well. But on another level, yeah, I've talked to a lot of people. Well, how do you be a better speaker, which is different than being a communicator? But how do you be a better speaker? Well, you know, you take exercises. You go and you develop your elocution. And then you have different people tell you, well, when you go on, you know, look in the face of the interviewer. No, look at the camera. No, keep your cheeks up. No, keep your cheeks down. No, smile. No, don't smile. And above all, be natural. You know, I mean, the point is that I went through a period of my life. I mean, I'm the inveterate student, right? I mean, so I was being coached. They were telling me how to do it. And they were really dealing with the externals. And I decided that, you know, the only way to communicate is to allow your convictions to come out. And then the mechanics will take care of themselves. So, you know, maybe I don't have a voice the equivalent of an opera star. But I have my voice, and my voice is not only the tone, but it is also the words and the thoughts behind them and the convictions that move them.
Now, has all of this affected your approach to making speeches?
Yeah. I throw away notes now. I don't make speeches with notes. I just speak. And I found it to be a liberating experience. I'm not tied to a text. I take, you know, a few thoughts, and then I elaborate. I mean, I know what I'm going to say, and I just elaborate on what those points are without worrying whether it is a written word, which is much different than writing a book. You know, in writing the book, mm-hmm. you have to write every word, and one sentence directly relates to the next sentence, and the words are very, very important. In the spoken word, frequently it is the pictures you paint with words, and it is the anecdotes, the stories you tell that bring people in that is more important than the kind of amassing of evidence and the logic of the argument.
I can see one danger of speaking without notes, and that is, say, a thought occurs to you that you think really belongs in this talk, and in retrospect, maybe that wasn't a good idea, and you're quoted, and it gets you into trouble.
Well, that's true. We live in a time where no politician is allowed a single mistake. Mm-hmm. One slip on a banana peel, and you're out. But that's going to be one thing I'm going to test, because I'm not sure that that's the best way to lead. I mean, and I'm not sure the media should assume that, you know, some missed fact is a reason for essentially attacking someone.
You say in your memoir that if the media environment and the political environment were in 1978 what it is today, you might never have run for Senate in the first place. How has the pressures and the public scrutiny of candidates changed since you entered politics?
Oh, it's become much, much more invasive. And it has become much more pervasive. There are more media...
I thought you were going to say perverse.
No, well, you can say that too. There are more media people and more people competing with each other and more people who need to edge and therefore more people who will go to greater distance to get the edge in terms of invading one's privacy. I mean, you know, I think that people have the right to know whether a politician or a political figure or a candidate is a crook, but not if they're a sinner, because, you know, in my tradition, we're all sinners.
Now, you've been in the public eye since you were about 17 when you were a star athlete. Is there a difference between being in the public eye because of sports and because of politics, a difference in the way you're treated and what people want to know and how put upon you feel by it?
Yeah, in fact, one of the reasons, one of the most relaxing aspects of playing professional basketball was that I thought when I came to New York to play basketball that the press was really going to be interested in all aspects of my life because there was a little bit of that in college. But I discovered they were only interested in what I did on that strip of hardwood under the bright lights in Madison Square Garden and how I thought about that. They really weren't interested in other aspects of my life. So there was this great zone of privacy that existed in professional athletics. In politics, there is less a zone of privacy, and you must fight to protect it. And so there is a great difference. I also think that the athlete's relation to the media is different than the politician's in that the athlete really doesn't need the media. I mean, the athlete's performance is there on the floor or on the field. There it is. And if they do it well, they're media stars. If they don't, they're not. A politician desperately needs the media because a politician conveys ideas, and those ideas are amplified through the media. And to the extent the media starves the politician of attention, then less people know about what those ideas are. So there's a great difference, in my opinion.
You write that you started feeling the same tenuous relationship with your constituents as a senator that you used to feel with a crowd as a basketball player. Would you describe that relationship?
Well, this was after my re-election in 1990. I mean, I won re-election by 3 points. I thought I'd win by 15 at least. And there is that similarity between the constituency and the game. In basketball, you're only as good as your last game. And with the constituency, frequently you're only as good as the last election. And then I realized that if you didn't have another election, well, then how would you measure how your reaction was if you weren't going to go out and do polling constantly, which I think would not be the right thing to do? And then you gauge that by your own interaction with them and by the stories they tell you. And after 6 months to a year, I realized after the election that, you know, it was unnecessary for me to look at them as if they were all against me. I just needed to hear what they said better, and in doing that, become a more kind of enriched person and a more effective politician.
Senator Bill Bradley has written a new memoir called Time Present, Time Past. He'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Senator Bill Bradley. Last August, he announced he will not seek re-election. He reviews his political career in his new memoir, Time Present, Time Past. Before entering politics, he was a star basketball player. He played for 10 years with the New York Knicks. Did you know you wanted to go into politics before becoming a professional athlete?
You know, the first chapter of the book is called Crystal City, and that's the small town that I grew up in on the banks of the Mississippi River, 3,492 people. There were 96 in my high school graduating class and one stoplight. It's the story of my parents, my father who didn't graduate from high school, went to work for the railroad, started working for a small bank, shining pennies, as he says, and ultimately became the controlling stockholder of that small bank. My mother, who was energetic, church-going, civic club attending, a college graduate, an elementary school teacher until she met my father. And my mother always wanted me to be a success. My father always wanted me to be a gentleman, and neither one of them wanted me to be a politician. So when did that thought first occur to me? Well, the first time that I thought about becoming a U.S. senator was in 1964 when I was in the United States Senate in the chamber the night the 1964 Civil Rights Act passed. I was a student intern that summer. And when I saw that act pass that desegregated public accommodations, hotels, and restaurants in America, I realized that America had become a better place, not only for African Americans, but also for white Americans, for all of us. And the thought occurred to me at that moment, well, maybe someday I can be in the Senate and help make America a better place. So that's kind of the moment that it occurred to me.
Why didn't your parents want you to go into politics?
Well, I think that my father was skeptical about I think he was probably skeptical about politics as a profession, whether it was honorable profession. And he was, you know, his experience was with a local politics that he thought was somewhat corrupt, and therefore there was a certain reluctance to encourage me to do that. But I remember in that same summer in 1964 hearing Robert Kennedy, who kind of clinched it for me, when he said, look, public service is a noble profession and politics is a crucial skill, and why don't all of you, he said to 1,000 college interns, excel at being human? And well, that kind of was irrefutable to me, and it had a big impact.
You were a white player at a time when the NBA was becoming increasingly African-American. And I'm wondering if you feel you learned a lot about race in America by playing basketball.
I learned a lot more than I taught, that's for sure. It is true that as a professional basketball player, I was living in essentially a black world, but that wasn't my first contact. I mean, I grew up in that small town, which was multiracial. I mean, I played on Little League and American Legion baseball teams that had African-American players, and therefore when we played in southern parts of Missouri, we stayed in third-rate hotels because none of us could go into a hotel because we had a black player. We were refused in numerous restaurants when we went in because they were segregated. I had a number of friends who were African American, both older and younger. I, you know, had that experience in 1964 about the Civil Rights Act in the Senate. So I had heard Robert Kennedy challenges to you know, follow politics and seek a higher level of ideals. And so all of that preceded coming into professional basketball. So I was in a sense ready for the experience. And the experience was an extremely enriching one, where I think I grew because of the extraordinary group of human beings that I traveled around the country with for 10 years. In that sense, I saw the world through their eyes. I saw how the world reacted to them. There were moments of gross discrimination. I mean, I remember Earl Monroe, who was a virtuoso player in Madison Square Garden. It's thrilling, 19,500 people, and an hour and a half later on 8th Avenue outside the Madison Square Garden in New York, trying to hail a cab and having some white men essentially call him names and beat him up. And the next day find him at the lunch counter in Los Angeles with his left eye puffed up and his anger burning. I remember seeing the strength of their individual families and how they thought about the country and their world and our future. And so, yes, I think that I also realized after 10 years of living in that world how much I will never know about what it means to be African American in the country today. So it was a deep experience for me and one that I tremendously value. And it also liberated me to a level of candor that I think is kind of absent. I mean, you know.
What do you mean?
Well, I think that Today, too often, we don't really say to someone of another race what we feel. We retreat to different corners of the room and shout at each other. And we're only going to get racial healing in this country when we actually have a candid discussion about race.
And you had those kinds of discussions when playing basketball?
I had some, yes. I had some of those discussions. But the experience of living in this world certainly encouraged me to have them wherever I was, not just in basketball. I also think that, you know, as a white player in a black world, I was subordinate in many cases to black players. I mean, our captain was Willis Reed, for example. I never forget in my rookie year, he called everybody on the team by their first name except me. He called me Bradley. I write about this in the book. And finally, I went to him after about 2 months of this in my rookie year, and I said, "Hey, Willis, you're calling Walt Frazier Walt, you're calling Dick Barnett Dick, you're calling Cassie Russell Cassie. How about calling me Bill, not Bradley?" And he paused and looked at me and said, "Okay, Bradley."
Yeah.
Which means, you know, look, you know, there's a pecking order here. And I think that, unless you're in the military, I don't think that has been the experience of many white Americans, where essentially they've taken orders from someone who was African American. And that's a nuance, but it's not an insignificant nuance, I think, because it goes to saying, you see the individual. You see the individual, not the skin color. You recognize the skin color, obviously, but it is the individual that is the key.
My guest is Senator Bill Bradley. He's written a new memoir called Time Present, Time Past. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Senator Bill Bradley. I want to talk with you a little bit about religion, which you write about some in your memoir, Time Present, Time Past. You write that your mother wanted a religious faith that was a personal support, and she had no interest in its applications to the rest of the world. And early on in your life, you'd rebelled against religion, but in junior high school, you attended a fellowship of Christian athletes, a big conference, and there you accepted Christ. What did it mean to you then to accept Christ?
It gave me a great deal of comfort. It gave me a way to locate myself in the world that I was living. And it gave me a sense that there was a group of people who shared those views. That's what it meant to me.
And then when you became a Rhodes Scholar and went to Oxford, you became disillusioned with fundamentalism. What happened to you there?
Well, I came to believe that there was an orthodoxy there that was alien to what I thought were the best aspects of the human spirit, and that the spiritual search was broader than that which was available within the narrow confines of a particular point of view within a particular faith, in this case Christianity. And I remember going into, and race entered this picture as well, because I remember going in my senior year in college, I had a lot of requests to go speak to various revivals and various church services, and people were not understanding that I also had a senior thesis to write, and if I was truly committed, I would put the speech ahead of the senior thesis, and I didn't really see it that way. And then I remember going, when I was at Oxford, into a church and hearing the minister give a full-fledged defense of white Rhodesian power, at which point I walked out and didn't return for many years. And over that time, thought and realized that there was something that was more to than what I had in life, and therefore the spiritual search renewed itself.
What do you think is the place of religious values and religious, you know, discussion of religion in political discourse?
Well, I think that as long as it doesn't become narrow and sectarian, that it should be legitimized as an individual search. I think that, you know, if someone asks a question, I'm more than prepared to talk about my own journey and my own life. I think that part of recognizing that this is going on in a lot of lives around the country and that it connects to our daily life, it connects to our public policy, is enormously important.
You've led a very disciplined life as a Christian, as a scholar, as an athlete, as a senator. Did you ever go through a period of just rebelling, going wild?
Well, sure, I wouldn't. It would always is a matter of, well, what do you mean by going wild or rebelling? But I think very much my time in England was a time of...
When you were a Rhodes Scholar?
Yeah, right. Right, that's true.
Couldn't have gone to see too much then, I suppose.
Well, no, I actually spent very little time doing what people thought one should be doing there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I traveled a lot. I was on my own search. I read novels instead of the text I was supposed to read in philosophy, politics, and economics. And as I write about it in the book, you know, what that meant when it came time to take the exams. Well, I was trying to do 3 years' work in 6 weeks, not always easy. But what I had done is use that time to personally search myself and also to have some fun and to meet a lot of people and to take some risks.
But was your life as a scholar and your life as an athlete at odds with each other?
I don't consider myself a scholar. My wife is the scholar in the family. She's a professor of comparative literature. I'm someone who's interested in a lot of things, have a kind of deep and abiding curiosity. I never found that was at war with that part of me that wanted to perform wearing short pants in drafty arenas around this country. I found that there was a complement. In fact, I found that the kind of curiosity often kind of deepened the athletic experience. For example, I remember one of my first weeks at Princeton, I walked into the gym, I'd broken a foot, so I was late practicing, and I was practicing in late October, and a guy walked in, and he had cut-off khaki shorts, he had carrying a squash racket, had a mustache, and I thought to myself, God, that odd-looking Englishman. And he said, can I get in the game? And I thought, what is he going to do? He gets in the game, he hits two hook shots going across the middle, hits me with an elbow, and I think, not an Englishman. And then he introduced himself, and he said, you know, who he was. And it turned out that he was one of Princeton's great basketball players, but he was also a PhD candidate in art history. And he said, do you ever think of taking art? And I said, what do you mean, drawing? He said, no. Seeing paintings like you see the whole court in basketball and finding things there that you never thought were possible. And from that conversation led to some art history courses and led to actually thinking about basketball and that aspect of my personality that had an artistic inclination as coming together. Mm-hmm. And that insight really led me to come back and play professional basketball because I realized that I was finding myself within the game as well as playing the game and that there were artistic elements to it.
Now, I want to get back to your decision not to run again for Senate. Do you think if you did run again that you'd win?
Yes, I do, certainly. I have no doubt about that. I think that that's really not a consideration or wasn't a consideration. The way I arrived at the decision was actually in writing this book. When I began the book 3 years ago, I didn't think I would end up by deciding I would not run again for re-election. And yet as I wrote it, I began to see, you know, you live life very intensely, and then you try to set aside some time for reflecting on the life that you've led. And I've tried to do that over the years. But then when you find the words to describe those reflections and the insights you've drawn, then it ends the experience for me. That happened when I was a professional basketball player. I wrote Life on the Run, about the life of a professional basketball player on the road in America in the 1970s. And when I'd finished it, I'd put it in perspective, and I turned the page. And as I was completing this, I realized that that was once again what was happening to me as I thought about another 6 years in the United States Senate. And I had to turn the page. At the same time that I was leaving the Senate, I was not leaving public life, as we discussed from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So very much it was a decision to go with where I found myself at the end of writing this book.
You've said the only way we'll ever get to the point where politics is more relevant to people's lives is to risk telling the truth as you see it to whomever. I'm going to ask you to say something that you think is the truth as you see it that you feel you couldn't have said earlier in your political career, or that you wouldn't have said.
I think that we are not going to have a healthy democracy unless we take money out of politics. I think that money in politics is a little bit like ants in your kitchen. They're either all out, close all the holes, or some of them are going to find some way in. And in the past, I might have provided campaign finance reform that was not radical. And now I think that we need radical campaign finance reform, and that has to happen from the outside. In addition, I don't think that there is this kind of absolute break between Senator before he said he wasn't running for re-election, Senator after he said he was running for re-election. In fact, what I find with my constituents is, and with most people, they believe the only thing a politician is interested in is when he is re-election. And so the only way to refute that is by not running for re-election. And when I said I wasn't running for re-election, it was as if a big ear opened out there in the public. And people were coming up to me saying, "You mean you really believe what you were saying about racial healing? You mean you really believe what you were saying about the plight of middle-class Americans who are stuck in their economic circumstance?" And my response is yes. So there is more of a continuity here. And when I was saying tell the truth, I didn't mean when you're out. I meant when you were in as well. And I have tried to tell the truth when I'm in, to whomever. So there aren't a lot of brand new things that I'd be telling people now, because I've tried to do it in offices as well.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. Enjoyed it.
Senator Bill Bradley has written a new memoir called Time Present, Time Past. Yo-Yo Ma's latest recording includes two cello concertos that, at first glance, seem an unlikely pairing: the famous Dvorak cello concerto and the relatively unknown second cello concerto by the operetta composer Victor Herbert. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that this grouping actually makes a lot of sense. Here's Lloyd's review.
Victor Herbert is the composer of the most beloved operettas this country ever produced. The Fortune Teller and Babes in Toyland are still put on in high schools. Naughty Marietta and Sweethearts were two of the most popular Hollywood vehicles for Jeanette MacDonald and Nelson Eddy. Victor Herbert's songs define a certain style of romantic excess. Ah, sweet mystery of life. I'm falling in love with someone. Kiss me again, even tramp, tramp, tramp along the highway. But there are things about Herbert many people don't know. First of all, he was born not in New York, but in Dublin. He studied music in Germany and was a distinguished cellist and conductor, as well as a composer of classical music. He came to New York with his wife in 1886, when he was 27, to be a cellist for the Metropolitan Opera. Though his more serious side is now almost completely forgotten, it turns out to be very appealing. Listen to the slow movement of Herbert's second cello concerto, which he himself performed at its 1894 premiere with the New York Philharmonic Society, and which Yo-Yo Ma, whose playing always has such a natural singing quality, has just released as part of his first recording with the New York Philharmonic. Thank you. The new Yo-Yo Ma CD begins with the most popular of all cello concertos, Dvorak's. I never made a connection between Dvorak and Victor Herbert, but they became friends and colleagues when Dvorak took on the directorship of New York's National Conservatory of Music, where Herbert had been teaching cello. They even collaborated on a grandiose but ultimately abandoned project for the 1893 Columbian Exposition in Chicago, The Great Discovery, a so-called spectatorio that celebrated the arrival of Christopher Columbus in America 400 years before. It was Herbert's first attempt at a stage work. The project probably influenced Dvorak's most famous piece, the New World Symphony, which he composed that same year. Dvorak started his own cello concerto in New York exactly 8 months after the premiere of Herbert's. It's twice as long, but it echoes some of Herbert's structural strategies. According to conductor Kurt Mazur, the main impetus for the concerto was Dvorak's longing not only for his homeland in Bohemia, but also for his beloved sister-in-law, whose health was failing. The slow movement even quotes her favorite song of his. In Kurt Mazur, Ma has a more sympathetic and flexible conductor than Lauren Mazel, who led Ma's earlier Dvorak recording with the Berlin Philharmonic. They choose a gentle, nostalgic sweetness over either the incisive ferocity of Pablo Casals or the more commonly portentous, rhapsodic rhetoric. Those old New York buddies, Victor Herbert and Antonín Dvorak, together again for the first time, are in very good hands here.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Yo-Yo Ma's new CD on Sony Classical called Concertos from the New World. This is Fresh Air. The makers of the popular French film Delicatessen have a new film called The City of Lost Children. It's a fantasy set in some unnamed future. Guest critic Steve Weinberg has this review.
The bizarrely compelling French film The City of Lost Children is like a fairy tale made by German expressionists. Here's the story. A pair of evil Siamese twins, schoolmistressy versions of the wicked witch sisters from The Wizard of Oz, tyrannize a crew of orphans, forcing them to steal and bring home the goods. The most ingenious and independent of the kids, sober-faced Miette, played by Judith Vite, runs away, joining forces with an ex-circus strongman named One, Ron Perlman of TV's Beauty and the Beast. One is in search of another child in bondage, his adopted kid brother, who has been kidnapped by a gang of one-eyed men, the Cyclops, and brought to a lab where a miserable scientist hooks himself up to sleeping children in order to steal their dreams. So far, he's been unsuccessful. He scares them so badly that all he can siphon off from their teeming brains is their nightmares. The story has elements of Dickens. The foggy, waterlogged setting evokes the French poetic filmmakers of the 30s, like Marcel Carnet, and the distinctly futurist atmosphere recalls more recent Hollywood fantasies like Blade Runner, and especially Brazil. It's as if the filmmakers, Marc Caro and Jean-Pierre Jeunet, who shared directing credit and co-wrote the screenplay with Gilles Adrien, screened all their favorite movies and then concocted an amalgam of bits from them. Logically, the film shouldn't work, especially since Genet and Caro are hopeless with actors, and they're not great about telling the tale clearly. What they can do is create astonishing image after astonishing image and sustain a mood of enchanted melancholy. And even if you can identify the sources, Genet and Caro, their cinematographer, Darius Kanji, and their set designer, Jean Rabas, bring a distinctive texture to these visuals. Genet and Caro had a popular and critical success with their last movie, Delicatessen, which was like Sweeney Todd, directed by Jacques Tati, the famous French farceur who wanted to aestheticize slapstick. But I found it far worse than the dullest Tati, overplanned, overacted, unpleasantly hyperbolic. This time, Genet and Caro have thought in terms of images, rather than just the mechanics of setting up a sequence. And they were smart enough to build in a strong emotional undercurrent to galvanize the images. The relationship between the strong man and the worldly wise child. The movie is full of strange moments that linger in your head, like a glimpse of the twins frying up dinner in tandem. One shovels food into her mouth, the other makes tasting noises. Or a shot of oil drips, illuminating the sludgy green river like chunks of phosphorus. These visuals are set against a lovely score by Angelo Badalamenti, best known for his work with David Lynch, and they give off potent exotic fumes, the kind a viewer can get high on.
Steve Weinberg writes for the Boston Phoenix and teaches at College of the Holy Cross. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.